From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! President Clinton rejects the Yugoslav proposal to end NATO bombing, a look at nonviolent alternatives to war. Also on this last day of Women's History Month, The Truth That Never Hurts, a conversation about race and gender. And the Seder Sisters, a group of Jewish feminists who lead a unique Passover dinner that celebrates women and liberation. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. NATO moved to escalate its aerial bombardment of Yugoslavia today, possibly aiming strikes at the center of the capital, Belgrade. As the conflict over Kosovo hit the one-week mark with no sign of ending, new targets could include the Yugoslav Defense Ministry and Interior Ministry. Western officials express new resolve to try to cripple a Yugoslav military machine they say is responsible for atrocities and ethnic cleansing of Kosovo Albanians who continue to stream out of the devastated province. At the Macedonian border today, refugees described a line of cars believed to stretch more than 3 miles into Kosovo, and they said Serb security forces were searching passengers. Brief hopes for a political breakthrough were dashed yesterday when Russian Prime Minister Yevgeny Primakov failed to persuade Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic to make an overture acceptable to the alliance. Milosevic insisted that NATO attacks stop before he resumed peace talks. He said he would pull back some of his troops in Kosovo if NATO halts its raids. That proposal was rejected yesterday by President Clinton. Russia said today it will send warships to the Mediterranean as a protest to NATO airstrikes. Meanwhile, the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague said today it has indicted a notorious Serb paramilitary leader for Bosnian war-era atrocities, an announcement seen as an attempt to stop him from deploying units to Kosovo. Zeljko Raznatovic, also known as Arkan, was indicted in September of 1997, but it was kept under wraps to try and facilitate his arrest. This according to Louise Arbour, the UN court's chief prosecutor. She refused to disclose the exact charges against him. And there's concern that Yugoslav forces are engaging in Nazi-era tactics. Germany says today it has reports that Serbs have set up concentration camps in Kosovo for ethnic Albanians. Tanzania has arrested a former Rwandan army officer wanted by both Belgium and Rwanda for his alleged role in some of the first killings of the 1994 genocide, paving the way for his extradition. Both Rwanda and Belgium have submitted extradition requests to Tanzania for Bernard Ntuhaga, who is suspected of involvement in the killings of Rwanda's prime minister and 10 Belgian peacekeepers protecting her. And a new Human Rights Watch report says the United States, Belgium, France, and the UN Security Council all had prior warning about plans for the 1994 genocide in Rwanda and could have prevented it. They said they failed to intervene after repeated warnings. The report is called Leave None to Tell the Story. The report said all the parties mentioned received dozens of warnings in the months before the genocide, but failed to act effectively. And foreign leaders reacted timidly and tardily once the killing began. An independent fact finder for the United Nations has said sexual misconduct by prison guards is common in women's prisons in the United States. The fact finder, or special investigator for violence against women, issued her report yesterday to the United Nations Human Rights Commission, which is meeting in Geneva for 6 weeks to examine rights violations around the world. And finally, concluding that Iraq has gone from relative affluence to massive poverty since economic sanctions were imposed against it after the 91 Persian Gulf War, a new report to the UN Security Council recommends several steps aimed at alleviating people's suffering. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
President Clinton yesterday rejected Yugoslav proposals to end the Kosovo conflict and said NATO would continue bombing Serbian forces committing atrocities against ethnic Albanians. Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic held out the prospect of a settlement to the crisis, with Yugoslav state television saying he would withdraw some forces from Kosovo if NATO halted the campaign of airstrikes that it began a week ago. Clinton said in a brief statement, President Milosevic's proposal is unacceptable. U.S. officials said the only way to halt the air campaign that NATO began a week ago is for Milosevic to stop a Serbian onslaught against Kosovo's Albanians, withdraw his forces, and accept a peace deal for the southern Yugoslav province. We're joined right now by Doug Hostetter. He is the International Interfaith Secretary for the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and he's head of the Bosnia Student Project of the FOR. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Doug.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
What is your response to the NATO-Clinton rejection of Milosevic's offer, and what is your understanding of what that offer was?
The NATO response does not surprise me at all. Partly because one of the frustrations that came out of the war in Bosnia was the United Nations essentially agreeing to the Bosnian Serb promises that they would stop their own ethnic cleansing and allow civilian monitors even in, but no armed monitors in. And the United Nations found itself in the very awkward situation during that war of supervising the humanitarian program at the same time while the Serbian army was killing and driving out tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Bosnian Muslims and being unable to do anything to stop it and standing by and giving food to the survivors. It was a very awkward situation for the United Nations to be in, and I think it was one that probably influenced NATO's decision not to accept that offer.
The Fellowship of Reconciliation has put out news releases calling for the end of the U.S. bombing and for creative resistance to genocide. What do you propose? What would be creative resistance?
Well, at this point, creative resistance will be much more difficult than it would have been earlier on. Before the bombing started, we, of course, were urging the president and NATO not to bomb, but to use tactics that would be much more effective. And even today, I think there would be great hope for some creative responses. I mean, first of all, I think it is astounding to me that the West has never, the International War Crimes Tribunal has never indicted Slobodan Milosevic for the war crimes in Bosnia that happened 7 and 8 years ago. And so I would think the first thing that should be done is that there should be an indictment of Slobodan Milosevic and an international arrest warrant should be issued for his arrest. And it should also be made clear that this is only the top of the pyramid of responsibility, and any military or civilian officials who participate in the continuing genocide that's taking place in Kosovo today also will be held responsible. That would only be the start. There are many other creative things that should be done. One of the things that I learned during the war in Bosnia and also am very aware of now is that there is a real morale problem in the Yugoslav army. There's a very high rate of desertion, and there's a very high rate of draft evasion taking place in Serbia now. They've gone on full military alert. All young men between the ages of about 17 and 50 are draft eligible, and young men all over Serbia are hiding from the army. The West should immediately, in fact, we should have done this a long time ago, have made statements that any Western NATO ally would offer temporary political asylum to any draft-age Serb or Albanian Muslim who presented themselves on any international border. This would greatly increase the level of desertion and draft evasion because many of the young men who were involved, even those who were involved in committing atrocities in Kosovo, would not like to be there. It is demoralizing as a military person to be fighting against civilians, to be killing unarmed people. And many of these people are in the services against their will. They were drafted into the services, and they themselves feel trapped in the situation. We could increase the level of draft evasion and desertion greatly by simply offering temporary political asylum until this conflict is settled and there's a new leadership in Belgrade. And if we were to simply take a fraction of the amount of money that the West has spent in this bombing campaign in the last 6 or 7 days, it's been several billion dollars. For only $1 billion, the West could afford to offer a $30,000 scholarship in the best universities in Europe or the United States to any soldier or special police or anyone who was evading the draft to come and attend school during that period of time. We could afford for less than $1 billion to give a scholarship to each one of the 30,000 soldiers that are in Kosovo today. I think there would be enormous response to that. One could also get much more creative. You could designate special ports in Greece and Macedonia and special airfields where you would encourage deserting airmen, soldiers, and naval officers to take their vessels with them when they go, and you could offer enormous rewards for people who brought their MiG-23s or tanks or other military equipment with them as they left the Yugoslav army. We need to be much more creative. One of the tragedies of violence is that war and violence really strengthens the extremes and terribly undercuts the democratic forces and the forces that are working for pluralism and tolerance in the country. And we've seen this very clearly both in Kosovo and also in Belgrade there. One of the real tragedies, the International Fellowship of Reconciliation has been involved throughout this conflict in, we have a small group of Westerners called the Balkan Peace Team that has been operating out of Belgrade and establishing relationships between the democratic and peace movement in Belgrade with the democratic and pluralism movement in Pristina. And, we have seen real progress take place in progressive Serbs, meaning progressive Albanian Muslims in Kosovo, developing strong lines of support and things like this. Immediately when the bombing started, these people all had to go underground. Many of them, many of the Serbs, unfortunately, had, although not all, had the reaction that most people do when their country is attacked. The tendency is to immediately to support your nation. You see it whenever American troops are in jeopardy in a military situation. Immediately, the popular polls swing to support the troops in the time of crisis. And when you yourself are being bombed, it then becomes treasonous to even talk about coexisting peacefully with the enemy or opening dialogue. So all of the people and organizations have had to either go underground or have shifted their allegiance from an opposition and a commitment to democracy and pluralism to coming in behind Slobodan Milosevic. And it is very much strengthened Milosevic. We have seen the same thing in Iraq, as we see in Serbia, that when you bomb a leader, no matter how unpopular he is locally, no matter how repressive he has been, when the outsiders are bombing, people tend to come together to support their leader, regardless of who that person is or what his or her track record has been. So we have made a very bad situation, a very disastrous situation, by our uncreative response.
We're talking to Doug Hostetter, who is with the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Doug, you have run the Bosnia Student Project for a while. You've brought in over 100 Bosnian students to study in the United States. You've also been receiving email from people in the Balkans. Can you talk about what you've heard?
Well, I guess the thing that's been most difficult for me and this entire thing is during the war in Bosnia, I helped to bring 154 students, many of whom were ethnically cleansed, to the United States. And one of the ways in which we got scholarships was I would take students around who were already here, and we would speak in colleges and universities, and I would simply ask them to tell the story of what happened to them and their family in Bosnia. And the stories were absolutely heartrending, stories of genocide, and actually I guess one could call it elitocide, in which what was done, I know in great detail, in northern Bosnia and in eastern Bosnia, was they would come in, they would take over areas which were predominantly Muslim. These people had been living there for hundreds of years. They would round them up. They would send them to sorting camps. In the sorting camps, they would go through and they would pick out all of the leaders, the political, the economic, the religious, the educational leaders. They would be sent off to death camps or would be killed on the spot. And then the women and the children would be pushed across the border into Croatia or back into Bosnian government territory. Unfortunately, it is so similar to what we are hearing from refugees today. There is no doubt in my mind that there is a genocide of enormous proportions taking place in Kosovo as we speak. Right at the end of the Bosnian Student Project, we took in several Kosovar students, and one of the students wrote to me on Sunday, on email, talking about getting through finally to his father in Pristina. His father is a well-known intellectual, and his email was absolutely heartrending. I will read just a little bit from this. He finally reaches him after many tries in many different locations, and his father said, will you help us? Will you help us? They are killing us. Help us. My colleagues are gone. Writers, artists, and activists. They have all gone. They have been killed. Their bodies and their have been massacred in the streets. And it goes on and on about how his neighbors and his friends and people who he knows intimately have been killed, and that he himself cannot sleep in the same house two nights in a row. He needs to go, and he ends by telling his son, whatever happens, don't come back here. We'll be all right. Stay where you are. Anything can happen in a war.
Well, Doug Hostetter, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Doug Hostetter, the International Secretary for the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Their phone number is 914-358-4601. That's 914-358-4601. Their website, www.nonviolence.org/FOR. The Fellowship of Reconciliation carries out programs on domestic and international peace and justice, nonviolent alternatives to conflicts, and the rights of conscience. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, today is the day second-degree murder indictments are handed down against four white police officers involved in the shooting death of Amadou Diallo, a Guinean immigrant in New York. It is also the day of continued jury selection in the Abner Louima police brutality case, and potential jurors have given written answers to questions about race, police conduct, and civil unrest. Among the questions, do you feel that law enforcement is discriminatory against blacks or other minorities in New York City? Do you feel it's appropriate for the police to use more force than is necessary while apprehending someone they believe is engaged in wrongdoing? It is a 47-page questionnaire are being used to screen the jury pool in the highly publicized racially charged case as it nears trial in Brooklyn Federal Court. Well, today is also the last day of Women's History Month. And while every month is Women's Month at Democracy Now!, we're going to put all of these issues together with Barbara Smith. She is a well-known African-American activist and writer, co-founder of Kitchen Table Women of Color Press, and she has a new book out called The Truth That Never Hurts, Writings on Race, Gender, and Freedom. Barbara Smith, welcome to Democracy Now! I also notice you are wearing a Mumia Abu-Jamal button. Can you talk about the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal and how you see it relating to the issues we've just discussed of police brutality?
Well, yes, we were talking before we began our conversation about the Millions for Mumia march that will be at the end of April. I'm sure that's been talked about a lot on Democracy Now! But I think what's really interesting and wonderful to me about this particular demonstration, it is an incredibly important issue because if he is executed, it will be the first time since the Rosenbergs were executed in the 1950s that someone will have been executed for their political beliefs. And in any event, as I said, this is a very important demonstration, and there is a rainbow contingent, a rainbow flag contingent that's building, and I think it's going to be one of the more exciting moments for the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender movement in relationship to the black movement and the black community, because it's going to be one of those instances when the communities come together around a common cause.
How do you connect issues like the imprisonment of Mumia Abu-Jamal to police brutality?
Well, it's really easy for me because I've been black all my life, and I was quite aware, of course, of racism long before I ever came out, long before there was ever a women's movement. One of the pieces in my new book is one that I wrote specifically for the book. It's a concluding essay in the book. It's called A Rose, and I begin by writing about what happened to Abner Louima in New York City in Brooklyn in the summer of 1997, and that's one of the pieces I very much like to read when I've been going around the country doing readings and signings. And one of the things I think sometimes to myself, now I wonder how the feminist audience is here, depending on who I'm reading for or presenting for, what they think about the fact that I'm reading and writing about black men who've been brutalized. But any injustice, you know, for those of us who are real activists and who are really committed to fundamental change and to economic, social, and political justice, we understand that all the isms and all the oppressions are connected. So as far as I'm concerned, anything that affects and negates human beings' lives is a feminist issue.
Actually, although you do have a little laryngitis, could you do a little reading for us from your chapter called A Rose?
I'll do my best. This is not my marked copy, but this is A Rose, and it also covers my involvement with Kitchen Table Women of Color Press in a much more personal way than my writing has generally been thought of. I do analytical writing. I do literary criticism, much of which is in the book. This is the first collection that I've ever done that is only my own work, and it's already sold out the first printing, I'm happy to say. But in any event, I write about Kitchen Table and also about a wonderful friend of mine who helped me to save the press in the mid-1980s when we were bankrupt. And what I'm trying to show in this essay is yes, our lives are horrible, compromised and attacked by racism, by hate crimes, by violence, but there are things that we can do to make it viable for us to continue to struggle and even to have fun sometimes. So that's what the essay does. So just a few paragraphs of A Rose. On the evening of Friday, August 8, 1997, Abner Louima, a Brooklyn resident and Haitian immigrant, went to a Haitian nightclub after a long week at work to hear one of his favorite bands. Although Mr. Louima has a degree in electrical engineering, he worked as a licensed security guard. As the club was closing, a fight started between other patrons, and Mr. Louima intervened to stop it. When the white police officers arrived, he was arrested. I then go on to describe what happened at the police precinct when they almost killed him. It was almost a lynching. He did not die. And then I talk about how he was handcuffed, and when he went to the hospital, that he was not even allowed to be visited by his wife, and he was handcuffed to the bed. And then this is the paragraph that I want to read, because this is where I began to talk about how I feel about it. For nights after learning what had happened to Abner Louima, it was difficult for me to sleep. Every time I awoke, I thought about him and felt the horror once again. Day or night, I was near tears whenever I focused upon what he and his family were going through. The despair and fury I felt were nothing new. Since childhood, I have been forced to live this nightmare again and again. In 1955, although I was too little to know what it meant, I learned 14-year-old Emmett Till's name when he was lynched in Mississippi for supposedly whistling at a white woman. In 1957, when I was 10, I watched 9 black students attempt to enter Little Rock High School while a mob of screaming white adults attacked them verbally and physically. In 1963, 4 black girls near my own age, Addie Mae Collins, Denise McNair, Carol Robertson, and Cynthia Wesley, were murdered when the 16th Street Baptist Church was bombed in Birmingham, Alabama. More than any of the others, their deaths taught me the measure of my life in the great white scheme of things. Somebody's daughter, somebody's neighbor girl, somebody's child, someone with carefully plaited hair and a crisply ironed blouse, someone whose people saw to it that she got to church every Sunday, someone like me, was in the end worth nothing, was a creature to be hunted down, obliterated, and killed.
Barbara Smith reading from her book, The Truth That Never Hurts, Writings on Race, Gender, and Freedom. Can we go back in time a little bit to the Kitchen Table Press? Some of our listeners might remember it, others might not, but I think it's very important in terms of organizing, in terms of setting up businesses of our own, just what you did with this Woman of Color Press.
Well, at the time that we started Kitchen Table, actually it was a result of a conversation between Audre Lorde, the great black lesbian feminist poet and activist, and myself. It grew out of a conversation between the two of us, and that was a conversation that occurred in 1980. At the time that we began Kitchen Table Women of Color Press, that has officially founded ourselves and announced ourselves in 81, a year later, there were virtually no mainstream publishers who published books by women of color or who targeted women of color as readerships. The common perception is that people of color do not read. And now, of course, this many years later, we helped build audiences for them. They got to take advantage because they had the capital, of course, to maximize marketing share and what have you. But the thing is, it was a little tiny press, literally, started over and on a kitchen table that actually made it viable for some women of color writers to have very successful careers.
Now, you're very well known for, among other things, your essay Toward a Black Feminist Criticism, often cited as a major catalyst in opening the field of black women's literature. Can you talk about the major themes you deal with in that essay, which is a part of The Truth That Never Hurts?
That has been widely published. At the time that it was written in 1977, black women's literature was not seen as a discrete discipline. No one knew that black women writers existed. You could say Zora Neale Hurston, Margaret Walker, Ann Peachtree, any of the people who I just love and who are now fairly well known. You could say also say Alice Walker and Toni Morrison. No one knew who they were. I started teaching black women writers in 1973, and I had very few people to talk to about what I was doing because nobody had read these people. Again, this is work that has had a positive result because because now most people would say, what do you mean nobody knew who they were? I know who they are because, of course, people like Oprah Winfrey now and others actually make movies based on their books. Do you see what I'm saying? So the first purpose of that essay was to say these women exist, these writers exist. And then I also do something that the essay is very much known for. I also wrote about black lesbian writers, which, of course, had never been done before in any serious way, in any kind of cohesive way. You know, there were almost no out black lesbian writers writing at the time. But in any event, what I did then was to look at Toni Morrison's second novel, Sula, and I did a lesbian reading of it. And that made the essay very well known, and lots of disagreements about the essay. Some people believe and say, I never understood what was going on in that book until I read your essay. And other people say, you're completely off the mark, including Toni Morrison. Mm-hmm. She didn't agree with it.
You also take on a number of hard issues, like homophobia in the black community and racism and women's studies.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about each.
Well, I mean, I guess there's something about my personality or perspective. I don't know what it is. I guess it's really what it is my politics that do not allow me to just take the easy way out. Because if I was taking the easy way out, I would certainly not be an out black lesbian writer. I would not be an activist. I wouldn't be a socialist. You know, socialism is supposedly over, but I don't think so. Because capitalism is still running roughshod over the world. So I believe in all those things. I believe in justice for all beings. So that's not the easy way out. As a black woman, you know, who was born before 1950 and 1946, who grew up in segregation, it's very important to me that my black community know that they know that there are lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people amongst them, that there always have been, that it's not a post 1969 post Stonewall phenomenon, and that homophobia is absolutely wrong. That any kind of hatred is wrong. I also have wanted my community to know that there are black women and specific black women's issues because of something called sexism that need to be addressed as well. So I have plenty of work to do. My work has always been cut out for me, it seems.
Do you think things are getting any better?
I'm not sure. What a question, Amy. I'm not sure things are getting any better because racism is an institutionalized system. You know, it's what the country was built on. And we see, as the century comes to an end, the 20th century comes to an end, we see the same kinds of hate crimes, like with the lynching of James Byrd in Jasper, Texas last year. We see the very same kinds of hate crimes that we could have seen either 100 or 200 years ago. That's an indication that something is not solved, something is not fixed. I think that in the cultural realm, like around black women's studies and black women's literature, that we have made some inroads, that students can now, I ask them, I meet students all the time on all these campuses where I speak, and I say, so what are you going to do your graduate work in? And they say, oh, I have a concentration in, you know, the politics of women of color organizing. I'm thinking, well, what? I mean, it's just so wonderful to hear. It's not that I don't understand what they're saying. It's just that in my day, you either did English history, you know, sociology, or whatever. It was not even available. So we made some changes there. We have a lot of changes to make, particularly in the real world.
In one of your chapters is on African-American lesbian and gay history. We talk about the problems in the different communities, but an actually proactive look at African-American lesbian and gay history. Talk about the significant milestones.
Well, I don't know that I can talk about milestones. I don't know if you're aware. That was my first written effort in a very long research process that I'm still involved in. I'm writing a book on the history of African-American lesbians and gays, and unless someone beats me to it, it will be the first book. And few are crazy enough to take on such a project, so I'm not so worried about someone else beating me to the punch, so to speak. But the thing is that it's not so much about milestones. I want to talk instead about why I feel motivated to do such a book, and that is to historicize the reality of there being people with different sexual orientations living in African communities and in African diaspora communities. This is very important information for people to have. And I have been going at that topic in different ways because my background and my academic training is in literature. I've been going at that topic at that goal or trying to get out that information for many years. This is another way to try to get it out. There's a piece in the book about James Baldwin, about my attending his funeral when he died in 1987, and how at this huge gathering of the Black literary and cultural and political establishment, no one ever mentioned that he was gay. And there were thousands of people at the largest Gothic cathedral in the world, which is the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City. It was never mentioned. And the name of that essay is We Must Always Bury Our Dead Twice. So as I said, I've always been going at that issue of making ourselves visible and having some understanding amongst and between the different elements who live in our community and in our world. But I think going at it historically is a really good way, because it's a way of making us last, so to speak.
What about other people in history that you think have to be noticed or have gotten acclaim, but have, for example, not been talked about as gay men or lesbians?
Well, the most obvious, that's a great question, Amy. The most obvious period that reflects that problem is the Harlem Renaissance. It has been known for a number of years, and even before, long before I began this historical research, those of us who were scholars in Black literature were becoming aware, if we were open to it, we were becoming more and more aware that the leading figures of the Harlem Renaissance, which of course was the pinnacle of Black cultural and political achievement in this century, perhaps up to the point of the Black arts movement of the 1960s and 70s, but until then. And then there's a kind of luster, you know, that the Harlem Renaissance still has, because the other period was more recent. But in any event, we began to see, understand and to know that many of those figures were either gay, bisexual, or lesbian. And what a revelation it was. And I can name names. There's controversy about who's who and what's what, because, of course, people made great efforts to hide who they were. But just for starters, Langston Hughes, County Cullen, R. Bruce Nugent, Wallace Thurman, Angelina Wellgrem Gay. Just for starters. And then there are others, too. People who were performers, not writers.
And then you have, in a different period of time, great politicians, for example, like Barbara Jordan, who just whispered about, but
exactly.
Not talked about as a very important part of
exactly.
Her life.
And that's really, people ask me sometimes, since I'm doing a lot of media and interviewing during this period with a new book, but people ask me, if you'd like to accomplish something, what are you trying to accomplish or whatever? Well, really, what I'm trying to accomplish is justice and an end to violence and hatred, you know, just decent human life for all. But if there was a more nuanced thing that I'm trying to accomplish, it is to have some understanding of how sexuality and gender actually do play a significant and positive part of the African-American tradition and the African-American struggle in the Americas or wherever else. In other words, that we can't just look at Black people as if they are one gender and one sexual orientation.
Barbara Smith has been our guest. Her book, The Truth That Never Hurts, Writings on Race, Gender, and Freedom. It is published by Rutgers University Press. When we come back, the Jewish holiday of Passover begins tonight, and feminists put on a Seder. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. At sundown today, Passover begins. The eight-day holiday celebrates the Jewish liberation from slavery in ancient Egypt. Traditionally, on the first two nights of Passover, Jewish families hold dinners or seders where friends and family gather to reflect and tell stories. 7 years ago, I went to an unusual Seder in New York City. Begun in 1976 by Gloria Steinem and Jewish feminist writers Esther Broner and Phyllis Chesler, the unique Passover dinner celebrated women and liberation. I produced the following piece for Pacifica Station WBAI in New York.
It's 6 o'clock. The women are arriving. In the dining room, there's no table, just two large sheets spread on the floor. Sheets covered with candles and one candelabra of little clay people with their arms reaching upward. You can put candles in each little hand. The women bring wine and dishes of food to share and put them in the living room for later. For now, aromas waft through the apartment. After a while, as more than 20 women fill the rooms, mothers and daughters and friends, Esther Broner calls the Seder to order. Actually, Seder means order, and the book that contains the ritual prayers and stories is called the Haggadah, Hebrew for the telling. Esther began writing her version of the Haggadah 16 years ago.
Welcome. This is our 16th Seder. This is the 16th time we've gathered together during the month of Nisan. Our reading in the synagogue this month was Leviticus, the listing of sacrifices. It makes me wonder what we as feminists sacrifice to gain a kind of spirituality, a closeness to holiness, or how we define holiness. So sacrifice is much on my mind. And war was the theme we settled on, and plagues we live under. For some of us, the war is not over. As a feminist, after reading Leviticus, as one of the tribe of Levi, the psalm writer, the singer at the temple, like Miriam, I would sacrifice, and first of all, patriotism from Patri, the fatherland. So this is
when did you write this Haggadah?
1976, but we revise it every year. Each year, the people around bring new ideas to it. So every one of the Seders for the last 16 years has been different.
What happened in 1976 that you did this?
We declared the Seder of the North, I and three friends, one in Knesset, Marcia Friedman, a social worker named Nomi Nimrod, and I. I was teaching in Haifa, Israel then. And we no longer wanted to serve. We no longer wanted to cook. We wanted to meditate. So we declared the men the cooks and the cleaners and the servers and the women the meditators. And we wrote new prayers that ultimately became this Haggadah. And the men were not altogether happy. But it began something quite radical. And then Nomi and I spent the rest of the spring term. I was teaching in Haifa, and she was actually attending my class, as was Marsha when she came in from Knesset. And I spent the rest of the spring term writing that. Every day we went and met, and we wrote it in her late father's study. He was a cantor, and Nomi was very nervous that we were doing something desecrating. Ultimately, we were so angry with what we discovered as we began reading about the Exodus and no women, about male attitudes towards women, that we knew that we had to make our own Exodus, and that's what happened in 76. So it was that long ago, and Ms. published in April of 77 about a third of it, which people still killed for.
What do you mean that the Exodus was only men?
Well, you read who left Egypt each time. Maybe there was one woman who left. And even when Miriam crossed the sea, she sang the same song that Moses did. She never had her own words. So by and large, the Exodus was the history of men. And it took five women to rescue Moses. It never tells about how many women it takes to rescue a woman and to make her a leader. So we felt it was a kind of paradigm that we could work with, and it turned out it had a lot of In fact, to my enormous surprise, it was very popular, even in the Xerxed form. Even pioneer Hadassah Naamat women used it. Your most traditional of women were enraged by what they felt was the cleaning, which I'm now in the process of doing, the cleaning of the cupboards, the changing of dishes, ultimately the serving. And what your big worry is to keep the meal hot. And it seems to me that religion doesn't have anything to do with hot meals.
Of meditation,
of planning, of being together. But it is not the traditional sweet 16. We gather in strength of our 16th year, determined not to be sweet or nice Jewish girls, but to meet constantly, subversively, insistently, and to invite, to honor those left out of the Seder, our foremothers, our singer Miriam, and to give her new songs, not war songs, but songs of crossing the sea, songs of the timbrel, songs of marching into the unknown, and with the women, with the strength, saving one's people.
Yashinatenu mekor habracha Shehechianu vekimanu vehigianu lasman hazeh
spread between us as sisters, and more people came into it. We now have 7 of us who make it, 3 of us who sort of inspire it, Bella and Gloria, who wasn't able to be here today, and Grace Paley. And each year we invite a new person. Each of us invites usually one new person, sometimes more, hoping that they will go forth like little cells, form their own feminist satyrs, and learn to reshape religion.
So what we're going to do is introduce ourselves by our matrilineage, our mothers, our grandmothers, our great-grandmothers, and by our new matriarchs. So let's go, let's see, we'll start to the left.
I'm not quite sure I know what you mean by a new matriarch. You mean somebody I choose to be a matriarch?
Yes.
Does it have to be alive or dead?
No, either one. It should either be one? Either one.
Well, since Bella isn't here, it'll be Bella Abzug.
That's all I
said. I'm Jenny Leah Zlata, and my mother is Michelle next to me. My grandmother, Nachama Leah, and my great-grandmother, Zlata. And
I'm Michelle Michal, but Nachama Leah, but Zlata. And let's make Gloria another of our matriarchs.
I'm Naomi, but Dvorah, but Faye, but Mrs. Grandma. I'd like to choose Rosa Luxemburg as my matriarch because she was an activist who wrote lots of love letters.
Lisa, but Diva,
but Esther, but Chayasura. And if I can choose non-Jews and non-humans, I'm choosing Jane Goodall and Flo, the old matriarchal chimp, is my matriarch.
My name is Meryl, my mother is Ruth, and my grandmother is Catherine, and I'm still searching for my matriarchs.
Mother of Nechama, daughter of Beatrice, daughter of Nechama, sister of Sivia, my other grandmother. I think my matriarchs are the women who are working for peace. From the WIMPs here on the west side, women indicting military plans and solutions, to the women in black who have not really been able to stand on their corners in the towns of Jerusalem, I think, since the war began. And I would like instruction in times of peace, how to continue fighting, and in terms of war, how to look towards peace from them.
And from the uncertainty of questions to the certainty of ritual, the blessing of the candles by mother and daughter. Letty and Robin Pogrebin.
Yeah.
And then to the annual repetition of the four questions. Traditionally, why is this night different from all other nights? Why do we eat matzah, bitter herbs? Why do we recline while eating? But at this Seder, at Robin's apartment, one of the daughters of the original Seder sisters, the questions were slightly different. They were asked by Jenny Landsberg and answered by her mother, Michelle.
Why is this Seder different from all other Seders? And why do we still feel the need to create a feminist Seder?
Because though it's 15 years since our rabbis, Phyllis and Esther, created a Seder that celebrated the exodus of women, we are still like a lost tribe. Men still want to sing solo at the Seder, in the Knesset, in the synagogue, and at the wall. Men still insist on making laws that govern women's wombs. While men still seek to silence our voices, Miriam's daughters must sing sweeter, bolder, louder.
But next year in Jerusalem, will women rejoice in the Torah at the Western Wall? Will all people pray in equal dignity together? Will the daughters of Pharaoh's daughters join us in the dance?
Our hope and courage.
And to the Litany of Dayenu, the English translation, it would have been enough for us. The song traditionally addresses God and is about abundance. Each verse recounts another thing God did for the Jewish people to liberate them from Egypt. And each verse ends with the word Dayenu. Just one deed would have been enough. The women's Dayenu addresses society and is about scarcity. How women's role in Jewish liberation was scarcely recognized. Each verse recounts one woman's achievement and says if just that had been acknowledged, it would have been enough.
If Chava had been created in the image of God and not as a helper to Adam, Dayenu.
Dayenu. If she had been created as Adam's equal and not been considered a temptress, it would have sufficed.
If she were the first woman to eat from the tree of knowledge and had been recognized as bringing knowledge to us, Dayenu.
If Lot's wife had been honored for compassion and looking back at the fate of her family in Sodom and had not been punished for it, Dayenu.
If our mothers had been honored for their daughters as well as for their sons, Dayenu.
If our mothers had not been considered as hardened roots or as fruit-bearing wombs, but as women in themselves, Dayenu.
If the just women in Egypt who caused our redemption had been given sufficient recognition, Dayenu.
If Miriam were given her seat with Moses and Aaron in our legacy, Dayenu.
If women had written the Haggadah and placed our mothers where they belonged in history, Dayenu.
If every generation of women, together with every generation of men, would continue to go out of Egypt, Dayenu, Dayenu.
Dayenu, 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 Dayenu.
How has the Seder and that your women's Haggadah changed over the years? You say you've added things to it. I mean, themes, for example, this year.
We've had the same spine. We go through the same material because in the best traditional sense of revision is based upon the traditional Haggadah, the telling. But some years we declare a Kabbalistic year. Maybe we meditate and think about the number 9. Some years we try to think about what is it that upsets us with each other? Why aren't we working well together? And we have an intergroup mediation. Some years we've talked of losses. 2 years ago the daughters took it and asked the mothers questions, and it was just deeply moving, probably the best Seder we ever had.
And so this year, the women talked about plagues, some internal and some external.
I think my plague is a sense of incompleteness. As a feminist, I'm very successful in my career, as in a man's career, by the way. And as a Jew, I feel that I'm successful in the sense that I've gotten married and starting a family, which is another sort of male world. But I feel that what I'm not successful at, and I'm incomplete at is in the world of women, that all the women my generation were so busy with our careers and our families and trying to juggle both that we've forgotten about each other and that we don't have time for each other. And for me, that's a great loss.
My plague is focused at this moment on my deep alienation from my own people and Israel, and I have never felt that more strongly. My whole young life was structured around the idealism of a collective Zionism, and bit by bit it's been torn apart. And I now feel, I feel as though a Red Sea has rushed in, an angry tide between me and Israel. And I see on the far shore a people marching. Their Moses is, I see as a dwarfish Moses screaming, force, might, beatings. And I will never be reconciled, and I will never be reconciled to the pain of being so estranged from my own people. And
did it ever, in your frustration in 1976 and before, did you ever think, just throw the whole thing out, create whole new traditions?
I know the deep feeling of spirituality that women have. I'm very sympathetic to earth religions and seasonal religions, and I'm totally unsympathetic to a hierarchical religion where you bend your back looking up at a god. But the women I'm with, and Benot Aish and other women, sort of work on the edges, trying to incorporate some of the past and trying to find a religion where the creative spirit comes from within rather than above.
Esther Broner hopes someday to publish the Women's Haggadah along with a history of the feminist Seder so that women will be passed over no more. For WBAI News, I'm Amy Goodman, daughter of Dorothy, granddaughter of Sonia and Gittel, great-granddaughter of Nahama, Gita, Rivka, great-great-granddaughter.
Well, Esther Broner did end up writing two books, one called The Telling, the other The Women's Haggadah, both published by HarperCollins San Francisco, and the women gathered for the 24th annual Seder in New York City this year as thousands read from the Women's Haggadah. Today I dedicate the program to my grandmother Sonia Bach, who will be 102 next week. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director, Errol Maitland. Special thanks to Brother Shine. If you'd like a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. For Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman.